From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
When it comes to climate change, elections matter. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Climate scientists say the danger is greater than ever, but Republicans call last week's election a mandate to roll back EPA rules against greenhouse emissions. That's the top priority of the incoming Senate Majority Leader, and the likely Environment Committee Chair says climate change is a hoax. First up may be the Keystone XL pipeline as the GOP pushes issues Democratic leaders never raised due to fears they might pass both houses of Congress. We'll hear what else is on the agenda and how Democrats and the president might respond. Today's talking point, awards for science worth more than twice as much as the Nobel Prize. First, the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again. I'm Armin Alney, back with To the Point. Republican majorities will try to reverse the president's war on greenhouse emissions and increase domestic production of fossil fuels. We'll hear how the president and other Democrats might respond. Today's talking point, tech tycoons gave big money to so-called breakthrough scientists at a lavish event in Silicon Valley last night. We'll hear what 60 people did to get a total of $36 million, with some taking home $3 million each. First, this news update. Just a week after being rebuffed by American voters in the midterm elections, President Obama is in China today for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. In Beijing, he announced visa expansions and stronger trade relations with China.
Deepening our economic ties is why I also hope to make progress with President Xi towards an ambitious, high-standard bilateral investment treaty that opens up China's economy to American investors.
Jonathan Pollack is Senior Research Fellow at the John L. Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution. Good to have you with us.
Good afternoon, Warren.
How important is this meeting?
Well, this is a core pillar of what President Obama has sought to introduce from the very outset of his presidency in one form or another. He was not able last year because of the governmental shutdown to attend these multilateral meetings in Asia. So the stakes are high for him, and beginning here in Beijing with the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, followed by a bilateral meeting with President Xi, a state visit, a brief one, then going to Burma and then going to Australia. But the reason it is so important for him is these go to, I believe, what have been his core objectives all along, which are related very, very much to the terms according to which trade, investment, and the like will be conducted, not only between the United States and China, but also with others in the Asia-Pacific region. Obama recognizes that the growth that is being sustained in the world economy is predominantly in Asia, not elsewhere, but he is very concerned that the rules and norms and procedures be established that are explicit and reciprocal. And that's what's underway. He's not going to get to full agreement on any of this at the APEC meeting, but he's got to give it his best shot at the meeting.
Is he suffering, do you think? You're not there, I'm not there, but do you think he's suffering a bit because of last week's elections? Is he viewed as weaker at home than he used to be?
I suspect with some that is true, yes. I mean, the irony here is because of rising concerns across the region about the growth of Chinese power and how it's being exercised, there is broad support for an enhanced American presence, including an enhanced military and diplomatic presence in the Asia-Pacific region. So you could say that the election outcome is the last icing on the cake. On the other hand, the question for not only people throughout the region, but also for the leaders of China, is would you rather deal with Obama over the next 2 years, even if you judge him to be in a weakened position, or are you going to do a roll of the dice and figure that things will be better if everybody sits on their hands for the next 2 years? My sense is that the stakes here are high enough that others are prepared to try to work with Obama, recognizing that he's got a big uphill battle on some of these trade agreements on a domestic front here in the United States, because he is the president. And if there's any area that he does have latitude over the coming couple of years, it's precisely on critical issues in economic and foreign policy, where he's the president, and he can articulate and pursue a set of goals, though it would be awfully good to have others along for the ride.
How important is the visa expansion? That is the one thing he's already done.
I think it's potentially very important. This has been something that has festered for a period of time. Visas are a real hassle in getting to China, and Chinese complain about the same kinds of problems getting here. If you make the process much more explicit and long-term, it's going to be a much better way on which business can be conducted and on which educational exchanges can be conducted. It makes a lot of sense, and the challenge now is to make sure that it is fully implemented on both sides so that these impediments to contact across the Pacific in both directions are not impeded, and in fact are facilitated and enhanced.
The president's going to China, then he's going to Burma, then to Australia. Why not Japan?
Oh, well, Asia's a big place. You can't go to all of them at the same time. He's not going to Korea on this visit either. He went to both Japan and Korea in April on his last visit to Asia. In this case, it's mandated more by the location of these multilateral meetings, which are obviously a great opportunity for him to interact with all kinds of folks on one-on-ones, in informal exchanges, plus his somewhat abbreviated state visit with Xi Jinping in China that will begin after the APEC meeting concludes on Tuesday night. So the fact that he's not going to Japan, I don't really think it really speaks to his, some slighting of Japan. He'll have a separate meeting, separate set of meetings with Prime Minister Abe, who will also be at the meeting in Burma and be at the meeting in Australia. So there are lots of opportunities here in this complex geometry that is known as international relations in Asia for individual leaders to interact with the president and not to make any kind of a presumption that we're favoring one over another.
Jonathan Balick at Brookings, I'm sorry to interrupt you. That's all the time we have. Thanks very much for being with us. In a moment, when it comes to climate change, elections matter. On To The Point.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren, I'll be back with To The Point. Despite new and increasingly dire warnings about climate change, newly empowered Republicans are gearing up to bolster domestic energy production. A likely first step may be the Keystone XL pipeline. Here's incoming Majority Leader Mitch McConnell with a prediction he made just a few weeks ago.
We have a new majority next year and a new majority leader. The Keystone pipeline will be voted on the floor of the Senate, something the current majority has been avoiding for literally years. And I think the reason they've been avoiding it for years is because they're afraid that it might pass.
That new majority will take charge in January, and the Keystone XL pipeline might just be the beginning. Ben Geeman covers energy and the environment for the National Journal. Ben, good to have you with us.
Warren, thanks for having me on the program.
Why the Keystone XL pipeline? How important is that, do you think, to what the Republicans want to get going now that they have the majority on both houses?
Well, it's long been one of their top priorities. I think a second big priority is taking dead aim at President Obama's climate change regulations, but I think we'll get to that in a moment. On the Keystone pipeline, the Republican pickups on election night make it pretty clear that they now have probably about 60, 61 votes in favor of the pipeline. Now, that's the combination of the 53 or 54 Republicans will likely have when the dust settles. And, of course, there are a number of pro-Keystone Democratic members as well. So, as you noted in the intro, it looks like a very strong possibility that fairly quickly in the new year, President Obama will be confronted with legislation on the pipeline. Now, both the president and his spokesman, Josh Earnest, over the last few days have been asked pretty much point blank whether the president would veto that legislation, and they really haven't answered the question. President Obama's answer actually was quite interesting at his post-election press conference. What he said was, look, I'm going to let the process play out. That's been going on for a long time at the State Department. And then he dispensed with that pretty fast and launched into a long answer about the U.S. oil and gas production boom and how great it is and how good it's been in his view for the country. And then he finally came back around to the pipeline and said, so that's just a small aspect of all this. And, you know, that's fairly consistent with a view that I think President Obama doesn't think the Keystone Pipeline is the job creator that its advocates claim it is, but nor does he think it is the disaster for the Earth's climate that a lot of environmentalists claim.
It is in the State Department because it involves taking shale oil from Canada, and environmentalists are saying that what's wrong with it is that the shale oil ought not to be developed.
Well, what it would do is actually it takes oil from the tar sands or oil sands region of Canada. And the reason that that's important, Warren, is because developing oil sands is a very energy intensive process. It leads to you need sort of more energy to get the stuff out of the ground and to separate it from all the other sort of gunk that it's bound up with. And then so the big concern among environmentalists about the oil sands is that it has a much higher greenhouse gas footprint than certainly that's a matter of debate, but it has a higher greenhouse gas footprint than the sort of lighter types of shale oil that you have in the U.S. And the concern is if you lock in this infrastructure like the pipeline, then you're sort of locking in development and the great expansion of that development for years and decades to come.
What are some of the other rules, EPA rules, that you indicated earlier the Republicans are targeting?
Well, the incoming majority leader, Mitch McConnell, who represents Kentucky, a major coal-producing state, over and over again during his campaign really took dead aim at these upcoming EPA regulations to limit carbon dioxide emissions from the nation's coal-fired power plants. This is this big source of unregulated carbon dioxide pollution. Now, these rules are the beating heart of President Obama's second-term climate change agenda. And so I think how the Republicans play this is going to be interesting because I think they will very likely attach measures to perhaps spending legislation that would nullify these EPA regulations. On the other hand, McConnell also said right away after he won victory in last Tuesday's balloting, he said, look, we're not going to shut down the government. That's off the table. So, you know, quite frankly, I think it's quite likely that they could force some kind of confrontation over the president's climate change regulations, these power plant regulations. I don't see them being able to overcome a veto of any type of legislation on that without risking any type, and certainly I don't think they're going to risk a government shutdown over it. So you're going to have a big collision over the climate change agenda and also perhaps other parts of the agenda, the climate change agenda as well. Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, who says that global warming is a hoax, is set to regain the gavel of the Environment and Public Works Committee. So that's going to provide him a very visible platform to do certain types of oversight and essentially, you know, beat these regulations with a political stick, express his view and the view of other Republicans that they're bad for the economy. But I think it's on those regulations, unlike the Keystone Pipeline, where you've really seen the White House essentially already draw a bit of a line in the sand.
You mentioned Senator Inhofe, who's written a book about how climate change is, in fact, as he refers to it, a hoax. Here's his own opinion and his own voice.
My point is, God's still up there. And this is the arrogance of people to think that we, human beings, would be able to change what he is doing in the climate is, to me, outrageous.
Michael Mann is director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. The hockey stick refers to a line on a graph indicating that global warming is a dangerous thing, and it got him in trouble when he first published it. Michael Mann, good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren. It's good to be with you.
Religion isn't the only issue here, but when James Inhofe says God controls the climate, not human beings, what are climate scientists saying these days?
Well, you know, it's really unfortunate to hear those sorts of assertions being made by somebody who is going to be heading up the Environment and Public Works Committee of the Senate. Look, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences has weighed in. Every scientific society in the U.S. that has commented on the issue of climate change, literally every scientific institution that we know of is on record that climate change is real, it's caused by us, and it will be a problem if we don't do something about it. And there's a worthy debate to be had about the policy. And that's, you know, and Republicans and Democrats should be at the table. Progressives and conservatives need to be at the table as we formulate a way to try to solve this problem. But there is no longer a worthy debate to be had about whether the problem exists. And that's what's so unfortunate about James Inhofe's words.
And when you say debate on the policy, what you mean is how we deal with what is inevitably going to happen.
Yes. Now, as a scientist, I understand quite well that if we continue with business as usual for even another decade, we will likely commit to a warming of the planet of more than 2 degrees Celsius relative to pre-industrial levels, about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit warming relative to pre-industrial levels. And scientists who have studied the impacts of climate change will tell you at that level of warming, we really start to see some very bad things potentially happen, and we start to lock in potentially irreversible changes in our climate. So I understand that as a scientist. Now, as a father, I think it's actually quite important that we preserve the climate and the planet for future generations. I don't want my daughter to inherit a fundamentally compromised environment. And I understand that that would be the danger if we continue with business as usual for even another few years. We have to bring our emissions to a peak within the next couple of years and ramp them down by several percent a year for the next several decades if we're going to avoid crossing that dangerous 2-degree level of warming. And, you know, we talked about you were talking about the Keystone XL pipeline. Building that pipeline would symbolize the fact that at a time we need to be bringing our emissions down, we're committing to infrastructure which will keep those emissions rising for decades.
Michael Mann again at Penn State University. Bob Inglis is with us, former Republican congressman from South Carolina, now the executive director of the Energy and Enterprise Initiative. That's a conservative nonprofit that works on energy and climate challenges. Bob Inglis, former congressman, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Warren. Thank you.
My understanding is that when you were a congressman, you felt one way. Now you feel another, that you have decided that global warming is, in fact, a serious a problem and ought to be dealt with. Is that correct?
Well, for 6 years, I said climate change was hooey, Al Gore's imagination. Then I was out of Congress for 6 years and came back for another six with a very different point of view, which was this is a serious problem that requires a solution.
So we need a solution. What about what the incoming Congress is talking about doing? Let's start with the Keystone XL pipeline. Michael Mann says that would be symbolic of how we're going to increase emissions rather than decreasing them. Do you agree with that?
No, I think that if the Keystone pipeline is built, it'd be okay. Because if we get a price on carbon dioxide, the stuff passing through that pipeline is going to be relatively more expensive compared to conventionally extracted petroleum. So the result will be some people may invest an awful lot of money in a pipeline that's pretty much a wasted investment. But bless them if they want to go ahead and build it and provide jobs in the meantime.
Okay. So you're saying it's okay to build it because it won't be effective, won't do what it's supposed to do?
Well, no, I think it could transfer a product, of course, probably environmentally in a more environmentally safe manner than by trucking it or by rail. But my point is that if we get this policy, which is a price on carbon dioxide, that the stuff passing through that pipeline is going to be disadvantaged relative to other conventionally extracted materials. So the result will be that the economics will inform whether that pipeline is actually used. And that's what we think at the Energy and Enterprise Initiative must be done, is to send a price signal here. To have what we have here is a problem of economics that has an environmental consequence. If we fix the economics, then the liberty of enlightened self-interest will guide consumers and suppliers to better technologies.
So you want to see a direct tax on carbon.
Right, and return that money immediately to the taxpayers in some form of existing tax cuts, in other words, cuts to existing taxes, or dividend the money back. But in any event, don't grow the government. Don't add new regulations. Rather, send a price signal so that in the liberty of enlightened self-interest, people make their own decisions as to what technologies they'll employ.
Let me go back to Ben Geeman, our first guest, energy and environment correspondent for the National Journal. How popular is the idea of a carbon tax amongst Republicans and Democrats in the Congress?
Not very popular at all. And at the moment, anyway, I know former Congressman Inglis has really been doing a barnstorming tour in recent years to try and change that equation. But right now, it is dead politically on Capitol Hill. And any type of price on carbon, be it through a carbon tax or through a cap and trade system, has long been a sort of big goal, or one of the grails, if you will, of the climate change movement. Because it does not have political support, that's why we're seeing the EPA going ahead with these regulations on coal plants, for instance, because we lack that overarching national structure. I think part of what we're talking about also gets to the differences in approach on coal and oil. With the Keystone Pipeline, you know, the State Department came out with a report in January that essentially said, there were some caveats, but it essentially said, look, whether you build this thing or not, this oil is going to be developed, these oil sands are going to be developed, and they are going to get to market. And so while the environmental movement, certainly some of the more aggressive and feisty wings of the environmental movement, are very strongly against it, and that is an important part of President Obama's base, I think that the Obama administration is putting more of its own political energy toward protection of these landmark first-time regulations on the nation's coal-fired power plants.
Michael Mann, back to you at the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. Are we running out of time?
Well, we are. If we want to stabilize CO2 levels below, say, the round number of 450 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere, pre-industrial levels were about 280. We've now passed 400, at least for part of the year. It changes seasonally, but we've now breached the 400 parts per million level for the first time, probably in millions of years. And we are headed to go past 450 parts per million within a matter of decades if we don't pretty dramatically bring our emissions to a peak and ramp them down. And one point I would make about that Keystone XL pipeline report, there was quite a bit of controversy surrounding this report that was commissioned by the State Department because of some of the authors and groups that were involved in the preparation of that report, it turns out, had a conflict of interest. They were actually tied to some of the interests who stand to benefit from the building of the Keystone Pipeline. And other independent reports have come out and argued that building Keystone would actually potentially lead to a substantially greater increase in carbon in the atmosphere than the report argued, and that actually it would make a difference. Building the pipeline would likely reduce emissions. Let me give you an idea of what the pipeline—
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you simply in the interest of time because we need to take a break. We'll come back. We'll let you finish your point, although I do want to ask very briefly Ben Geeman of the National Journal, does the Keystone XL pipeline seem to have enough votes to pass? Would the president have to veto it?
Yes, it does. I think with the results we had on election night, I think we see it's already easily passed the House on multiple occasions. And with I think we're now going to see about 60 to 61 total votes in favor of it on the Senate side, which is, of course, a filibuster-proof majority.
Okay. We'll come back. We'll talk about that and let Michael Mann finish his point. We're also going to talk about Alaska, where these issues are immediately important. On our talking point later, 60 scientists received cash awards last night in Silicon Valley. 11 of them got double the cash that comes with a Nobel Prize. We'll hear what that was all about. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Dad.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, talking today about climate change and energy production here in the United States and the differences between the Republican and Democratic parties, at least some in the Democratic Party. Quickly, Michael Mann at Penn State University, author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. You had a point you wanted to make, and I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No problem. So, yeah, the point I wanted to make about the Keystone pipeline and the Canadian tar sands oil, there was a study that came out last year that estimated how much warming you could potentially get if you extracted essentially all of the potentially extractable carbon from the tar sands. And it turns out it's probably somewhere in the range of a half a degree Celsius. Now, that might not sound like a lot, but remember, I said that many scientists think that if we pass the 2 degree Celsius mark relative to pre-industrial, that's where we really do commit to some of the worst potential impacts of climate change. We've already warmed half of that, 1 degree Celsius. Another half a degree is already locked in. It's already in the pipeline. We will see it just as the surface of the Earth slowly and the ocean slowly warm up in response to the carbon we've already put into the atmosphere. That means to avoid 2 degrees C, we only have a half a degree Celsius to work with. And the Canadian tar sands would probably put us over that 2 degree limit.
Okay, so it is then significant in the whole argument. It's not just a matter of transporting oil from one place to another.
Can I make one more point? I just wanted to emphasize that Congressman Inglis is a hero to many of us because I think he serves as a reminder that this doesn't have to be a partisan political issue. And I think it's great that conservatives are coming to the table and offering free market approaches to dealing with the climate change problem. That is a worthy debate, and that's the debate we should be having. We shouldn't be debating whether or not climate change exists, whether climate change is a hoax. There's no place for that.
One of those who is, in fact, making the argument for a free market approach is Bob Inglis, the former GOP congressman from South Carolina, now with the Energy and Enterprise Initiative. Why do you think it is, Congressman, that so many in your party deny that there is such a thing as human-caused climate change?
Warren, I think mostly because we don't like the solution. If you offer me a solution that's anathema, then I'll doubt the existence of my problem. That's just normal human behavior. And so I think that's what we're seeing is conservatives don't like the solution. An assumed bigger government that taxes more, that regulates more, that grows a nanny state, that reduces liberty, well, that's anathema. And so what we need to show is there's actually a free enterprise solution. Just put all the cost in, eliminate all the subsidies, and watch the free enterprise system sort it out. And something very important that Ben said earlier is carbon tax is not so much dead in Congress. It's that it's never been born in Congress. And so, in fact, we're in the process right now of birthing that. It's something called republicen.org, republicen.org, where we're developing this group of conservatives who would step forward and stop asking the question, is climate change real? That's fairly settled. The question we should be asking is, can free enterprise solve climate change? That's a much more exciting question.
Are these people that you say are ready to step forward members of Congress or not?
Not yet. It's a building year, Coach. We gotta build support for this, and we gotta show that the conservatives who are concerned about climate change are not alone. Because up until now, it's been the province of the left. The environmental left tells us about climate change, not conservatives. So what we're trying to do is change the conversation at republicen.org, is to show that there are these conservatives who want to step forward with bold belief in free enterprise, that really free enterprise can answer this question. If you just fix the economics, put all the cost in on all the fuels, eliminate all the subsidies, then individual consumers and the liberty of enlightened self-interest will pursue their self-interest, and we'll have solutions and new technologies that aren't available today.
Let me go back to Ben Gaiman, our energy and environment correspondent for the National Journal. Tell us how a lot of these issues are coming to a head in the state of Alaska, which is experiencing global warming. You can see it happening there. And yet, of course, it's also a major producer of oil and gas.
Well, that's right. And one way that they are all coming to a head in the somewhat near term is that Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, with the Republican takeover of the Senate, is now going to be the chairwoman of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. And that puts her in a very strong position to advance some things where there actually just might be a sliver of opportunity for political compromise. Now, of course, political compromise on anything, certainly energy, is such a scarce commodity these days, I'm not sure I would bet on it. But there are two things that Senator Murkowski is very interested in that are very important to her home state's oil and gas industry and really the country's as well. She really wants the U.S. to lift what's a sort of de facto ban or at least really heavy restrictions on the export of crude oil. She also, and a lot of other members, you know, honestly from both parties, want to see faster approval of proposals to export liquefied natural gas. And so to the extent that perhaps there's a little bit of opportunity for some political compromise, again, far-reaching as that might seem, I think we might see it in some of those proposals. And, you know, again, speaking of Alaska, they're real important for Alaska. That's a state that has seen its oil production really declining for quite a while now. There's also a lot of what people, I suppose, would call stranded gas up in Alaska, a lot of gas that right now there's not a great or really much of an ability at all to get it to market. And so that's another reason why sort of large-scale LNG exports would be of interest to her states. And I promise you both things are very much on her mind as she takes over that gavel for that energy committee.
Well, let's go, if we can't go direct to Senator Murkowski, let's at least go to Alaska, where Gwen Holdman is director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska, which is in the Fairbanks campus. Gwen Holdman, thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning, Warren. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit, elaborate a bit on what we just heard from Ben Gaiman about why this is such a tough issue in your state.
Well, you know, I think Alaska is a little bit in a unique position because we are extremely dependent on our fossil exports of fossil fuels from Alaska. The majority opinion in Alaska is that we need for America to use our fossil energy resources to keep us competitive. We're producing more energy in this country than ever before from all sources, and that's actually a good thing because we do need cheap, reliable energy to fuel a strong economy.
So what does that mean then? Are Alaskans in favor of not rolling back the EPA regulations that we heard about earlier?
Yeah, you know, I don't feel like I'm necessarily in a position to speak about EPA regulations per se, but what I can say is that, you know, on the climate change front, most Alaskans think we do need to take it very seriously. The general consensus is it's real, it's happening, we can see it in our own backyards, and we've got to adapt to that reality. Whatever's causing it, it's actually here today. At least in Alaska, we're seeing it on a daily basis. And
so tell us what it looks like.
Yeah, I was just up in a tiny coastal community called Teller yesterday. I just flew in from Teller, and we had the remnants of Hurricane Nori that was still sort of impacting the coast up there. And historically, sea ice has been landfast in the Bering Straits region. And now, when you get these big fall storms, which have been happening, you know, for forever, there's no landfast sea ice in the fall. And so you're having these huge issues, for example, with coastal erosion because you're having storm surge and waves that are coming up on shore that are washing away, you know, what are pretty pretty unprotected stretches where a lot of these communities are located. And these are very vulnerable, pretty impoverished communities. Teller, where I just was, has no indoor plumbing, no running water, and it leaves a lifestyle very much still driven by local resources. I think most people would be surprised to know that a community like this actually still exists as part of the United States.
So people like that obviously are immediate victims of climate change. Is there sympathy for them in the rest of the state?
I think it's considered to be a really significant challenge statewide. Here in Fairbanks, where I'm in the interior, we have seen a 50% increase in our growing season over the last 100 years. That's just a fact. That's measurable data based on frost-free days. And so we're seeing that change all over the state, and there is a lot of concern on how we mitigate that. That's really where the focus here in Alaska is. Climate change is happening. We can maybe argue about what is causing it, but it is real. It's here today, and we need to develop strategies to mitigate the effects that we're seeing.
Are there ways that Alaska might benefit from climate change?
Well, when you live in a place that regularly gets to 60 below in the winter, you know, gaining a couple degrees doesn't necessarily sound so bad. I do think, you know, it is something that people are very much thinking about. They're very concerned that it's going to impact their way of life. For example, right now up in Teller, they're in the midst of subsistence seal hunting on the edge of the pack ice. That's what they're doing right now. And yet there's really not much pack ice. And so that's making it a lot more challenging for them to do subsistence hunting. They're also very concerned about the opening of the Arctic. You know, we're starting to see a lot more oil and gas activity in the Arctic beyond the Prudhoe Bay, beyond the existing oil fields, you know, out in federal waters and on the coastal, out off the coast. And so that's something that people are pretty aware of and keyed into. You know, to some degree, we're very supportive of oil and gas development, but we want to make sure it's done in a responsible way. And more, the easy and easy to extract resources have already been developed. So now it's more and more of a focus on these more difficult, challenging, and higher risk resources and making sure that we have strategies in place if there's an oil spill in the Arctic, for example, are very important to Alaska and especially to the coastal communities.
Is there development of renewable energy sources in Alaska?
Yeah, what's very interesting, what Alaska's done, and I think that this could also be a model for the nation, and I believe Senator Murkowski's espoused strategies along these lines, is that we've invested a good portion of the money that we've received in terms of tax revenue from oil and gas development, in particular oil development, into renewables. And Alaska has spent more money per capita than any other state in the country for renewable energy projects. And today, our community are very isolated and independent. They all have their own little power grid, their own power plant that just serves that little tiny local community like Teller, 300 people. They have their own power plant. They're not connected by electric lines to anyone else. But our communities that are served by these kind of remote microgrids represent 15% of the entire world's microgrids that are served by renewable resources, including wind and geothermal, hydropower. Solar is gaining popularity up here. And I think that this is something that's a little bit of an untold story about Alaska. We've gotten very, very good at incorporating high levels of local, often renewable resources with our diesel generation, which is the power workhorse of power generation in rural Alaska. And that's something that I think it could be replicated in other places as there's more and more interest in other regions becoming electrified.
Gwen Holman, once again, the director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska. Bob Inglis, our former congressman from South Carolina, now with the Energy and Enterprise Initiative. Does that sound to you like a model that ought to be adopted or could be adopted in other parts of the country?
Oh, it's very exciting what Gwen is talking about, particularly if you leave it to people to, once they've got a price signal, to then make choices between the energy mix that they're going to take at their homes and businesses, then all kinds of exciting things will happen. And we here in South Carolina will do it differently than Gwen in Alaska. But we will be motivated by the same thing, which is we've been told the truer cost of our electricity, the truer cost of our petroleum, natural gas. And the result is once those costs, those hidden costs, are now revealed and included in the price, then I'll make decisions here in South Carolina that might be a little bit different than Alaska, but they're going to be decisions that have real impact because millions of people will be making those decisions. Not because some government regulator told them what to do, and then they try to evade those regulations, but rather a price signal comes to them, and then they respond in enlightened self-interest.
Michael Mann, back to you at Penn State University. You said earlier you'd rather see the debate about economics and about problem solving rather than debate about what causes the problem. Is this a constructive way to go?
Yes, I think we have to accept what the science overwhelmingly is telling us, and that every credible scientific institution in the world that has weighed in has said very clearly climate change is real, it's caused by human activity, and it will be an increasing problem if we don't do something about it. So let's get on to that very worthy discussion and about how to solve the problem. And I think, you know, the approaches that Congressman Inglis is talking about, that's precisely the sort of discussion we should be having, because there is a very credible case that can be made that this problem can be solved in the context of market mechanisms. There's some people who think that isn't possible. I personally am convinced that it is possible, as long as we level the playing field, as long as we make sure that those hidden costs that the congressman refers to, the hidden cost of burning carbon and putting it into the atmosphere, is internalized. So it's part of the cost-benefit analysis that plays out in the market.
Back to Ben Geeman, again, the energy and environment correspondent for the National Journal. How does this kind of thing sound in Congress? You indicated earlier you thought that the idea of a carbon tax was dead on arrival. Bob Inglis says it's not, that it hasn't been born yet.
Well, going past for a second, the kind of question is of at what point does does life start for a carbon tax? I think certainly for the foreseeable future, there are not political legs for a carbon tax. I think, as the former congressman mentioned, some of these conservatives that he's rallying to the cause, forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think I heard him say, are not yet members of Congress. So getting any type of carbon tax through the Beltway is a much longer-term process. Now, on the question of renewable energy, there is, you know, support to some extent across the aisle for that, and a lot of that has to do with just what we were talking about in Alaska, which is you see states where different types of renewable energies have really gained a foothold and taken off, and it's not really necessarily a red-blue divide. So you've got, in Iowa, you've got a lot of wind power. In Texas, you've got a lot of wind power, and in the Plain states as well. And that's why, for example, Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, a Republican, a very prominent Republican, he has long been a supporter of tax credits for wind energy projects that have since lapsed. And one of the big fights, I think, heading into the upcoming months ahead are whether or not whether or not there's any sort of political opening for renewal, for a re-upping or renewal of some of those green energy policies that at least have some support across the aisle.
What about the Democrats and the president? We haven't talked about them really at all. There seems to me there's plenty of room for compromise, but is there going to be that, or are we going to have to wait another 2 years?
Well, you know, it's sad but true that we're almost already into another presidential cycle as it is. And so I think the openings for that are going to be pretty few and far between. And it really depends on the topic, too. I mean, on something like killing President Obama's climate change regulation, I don't think there's any room for compromise there. Perhaps there is, as we were discussing before, on some things where you have at least some support within the administration on fossil energy exports. You mentioned the Democrats. I'm actually very interested to see how the Senate Democrats position themselves politically now that they are in the minority on climate change, because you have a number of members like Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, a self-described climate hawk, and Barbara Boxer and some others. And they, about a year, getting on a year ago, they said, look, we're going to really try and seize the political offense on this issue. And the response has really been, or their efforts have really been a bit of a mixed bag. And I think in part, one of the reasons for that is Harry Reid, over the years, has protected some of his more conservative Democrats from some tough votes and from really elevating the issue of climate change at times. He certainly hasn't been silent on it. He's done several things, but a lot of the time it's not very prominent within the Senate. Now that a lot of these sort of right-leaning Democrats are not going to be there, I'll be really curious to see whether Democrats fighting from the minority really sort of get more aggressive on challenging Republicans on their, you know, skepticism, denial, call it what you will, of climate science. I'm really curious to see what type of how aggressive and pugilistic those Senate Democrats can become.
All right. Some very interesting things to be looking for when the new Congress convenes in January. Of course, there's the lame duck Congress. In the meantime, no doubt these issues will not arise then. Ben Geeman again, energy and environment correspondent for the National Journal. Many thanks to you. Michael Mann, director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Bob Inglis, former former congressman from South Carolina, now at the Energy and Enterprise Initiative, a man who's changed his mind about climate change, and Gwenda Holdman, director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. Many thanks to all of you for being with us today. At a lavish ceremony last night near San Francisco, 60 biologists, physicists, and mathematicians shared a total of $36 million in prizes. 11 of them got $3 million each, twice the cash value of the Nobel Prize. We'll hear where the money came from and why in a moment on To the Point.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
Well, we're not only back with today's talking point. The so-called breakthrough prizes for scientists were created 2 years ago by Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, Google founder Sergey Brin, and the Russian billionaire and venture capitalist Yuri Milner. James Temple is a senior editor at Recode. That's a science and tech website. He attended the award ceremony last night. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell us, first of all, where it was. It was in that huge hangar near San Jose, right?
It was. It's, I think it's technically Moffett Field, but it's in the NASA Ames Research Center inside of Hangar 1 there.
And it's a giant. If you've ever driven in that area, any of you around the country, you would recognize it and remember it. So tell us what the ceremony was like.
Well, as you said in the intro, it was a lavish affair. You know, there were a lot of celebrities on site. Benedict Cumberbatch was there, Cameron Diaz, Christina Aguilera sang, and Thomas Keller of the French Laundry provided food for the event.
So what was it all about, and why did these 60 scientists deserve all that money?
Sure. Well, the whole point of it, which I think is a really interesting one, is that society sort of often celebrates and casts a spotlight on celebrities, athletes and actors and musicians and so forth. But some of the people doing the most important work in the world, scientists who are working to, you know, better understand the universe or cure tragic, horrible diseases, often you don't even know their names. And so this was an effort, and it's now an annual event to both recognize some of the scientists doing some of the most important work in the world, and also to provide them money so that to compensate them more like a celebrity is. So it's funded, as you said, by a lot of Silicon Valley's biggest figures.
Are they directly trying to compete with a Nobel Prize or sort of expand the whole idea?
I certainly don't think that anyone there wants to displace the Nobel Prize. I think that, you know, that they recognize that as being a very important event in its own right, but that this is a somewhat, in some ways, maybe a more casual affair. They want it, not that it's casual per se, but it's designed more to be like an Oscars type event. And to provide additional money, because there's, you know, only so many Nobels that are passed out in any given year. And here there's, you know, as you said, you know, $36 million awarded across dozens of scientists.
And this really is worldwide. I forgot to mention Jack Ma from Alibaba. He was involved as well, the Chinese tech entrepreneur. So what struck you as the most important awards? Was it the ones that got the most money?
I mean, it kind of depends. I think the thing that resonated the most with me last night was when a neurosurgeon, Alain Louis Benabid, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, was recognized for his work on deep brain stimulation. And this is this technique that's really dramatically improved symptoms for people dealing with Parkinson's disease and other nervous system disorders. And they showed a video on stage of this young boy thrashing around in his wheelchair. And then when the lights came back up, the now young man walked out on the stage.
Wow.
Unassisted and said thank you directly to the scientist himself. And I think, you know, we heard a lot about these important but somewhat abstract scientific improvements that have taken place, but there was just this really visceral sense of the power of science to improve lives.
Yeah, it must have been a very moving moment.
It was, yes.
Did you get to meet any of the people that won the awards?
Actually, I didn't actually get to meet any of the scientists themselves. A lot of them sort of walked along the rope line and did quick interviews with people, and so I overheard a few conversations. I did talk to our site is more of a tech-focused site, and so I talked to some of the tech folks there. I talked to Elon Musk briefly to get his take on, you know, why the event was important, and the point that he made was that it's inspiring potentially for not just today's scientists, but for people who today are students and considering what career path they want to take. And he specifically said he'd rather see people moving into breakthrough technologies in science than, you know, preparing for careers in Wall Street.
You described the extraordinary situation with the young person with Parkinson's who got deep brain stimulation. I understand there was also prizes for astronomy, for discovering that the universe is expanding, not shrinking.
That's true. There was that was, I think, a $3 million prize that was split among the biggest group, I think almost 50-some scientists who all sort of were working on the various approaches to this idea. And I think it had set out to prove that the expansion of the universe was slowing down, and what everyone kind of found independently was that, in fact, that long-held view was wrong, and the universe is expanding at a faster clip.
So obviously a tremendous range of different kinds of discoveries and things for which prizes were given. Mm-hmm. How complicated a process is it for the people involved to seek these people out and find them and decide who wins and who doesn't?
You know, I don't know the ins and outs of how that process takes place. I do know that they have very prominent people that are helping to make that decision, and I understand that Stephen Hawking, the famous cosmologist, is involved in that process, as there are other top scientists in their respective fields. So, I don't know exactly how they begin and how they winnow it down, but they have some of the world's smartest people set to work on deciding who some of the world's smartest people are.
So it would appear. And I gather the money, as you indicate, it's compensation. They can spend it any way they want. They aren't required to use it for continued research, for example.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting point. I think my bet would be, I don't know this, I haven't asked anyone, but my bet would be a lot of people do use it to continue pursuing their research, because research dollars can be a lot harder to come by than, say, venture capital. But, yeah, if you just want to pay down your mortgage or pay off your car, that's perfectly legitimate as well. And, you know, the sort of option that a hardworking scientist doing some of the most important work in the world certainly should be allowed to avail themselves of.
And no immediate advantage required for the people who came up with the money. They just did it on their own. James Temple,
exactly.
We're out of time. Senior editor at Recode. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I really
once again attended
it.
The Breakthrough Prize event last night in Silicon Valley. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.